Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly analysis of major economic events and trends, the forces, national and global, that shape our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, what we buy and what we pay for it, everything having to do with the economy. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I'm a professor at the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org. It is a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. Check them out at truthout.org. Many of you are interested in pursuing the stories and the analytics that we offer on this program. There are basically two ways to do that. And that's to go to our two websites, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites contain elaborations of the kinds of analysis you hear on this program. All of these programs are archived there going back 2.5 years now. Every week's program is available there. Documents, video lectures that I offer, classes that I teach, and so on. On the democracyatwork.info website, you will also find all the materials relating to the notion of worker self-directed enterprises and the kinds of solutions they offer to the problems analyzed on this program. It's also possible, through either of the two websites, to send us your comments, your questions, whatever you have to say that might help us shape what we offer to you on this program. So please go to the websites also to communicate with us. Once again, rdwolf.com and democracyatwork.info. And finally, please remember to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. These are ways to use social media to communicate between you and myself. Let's turn then to the economic updates for today. I want to begin by talking about a document, a report, that was prepared, the document, by the Credit Suisse Bank. They produce an annual World Wealth Report. It's one of the largest banks in the world, based in Switzerland. And we'll have several things to say about Switzerland in today's program. The Reuters News Service on October 9th of this year, this month, reported about the Credit Suisse World Wealth Report. And before I tell you what the report shows us about world wealth, I want to develop briefly a concept about how capitalism, which is the economic system that dominates in the world today, how it is a system of extraordinary uneven development. That is, it's a system that develops part of the world into a high level of income and a high level of technological production, while condemning a large other part of the world to the opposite. It is a highly uneven system. Obviously, since we're still in the crisis that hit in 2007, it's an unstable system, but its instability, its bouncing up and down, which is a serious problem, is separate from the long-term tendency it has to produce gross inequality. So here are some of the basic statistics. Global wealth has risen by 68% over the last 10 years. That is, despite the crisis that has hurt so many, global wealth has increased by 68%. And the United States accounts for 3/4 of that increase. Okay. Average global wealth has hit $51,600. That's the wealth per adult on this planet. However, the 10% richest people on this planet own 86% of the wealth. Let me do that again. The top 10% own 86% of the wealth, which means that the other 90%, the rest of us, have to share the remaining 14%. The numbers aren't complicated. The top 10% have 86% of the wealth on this planet. That is a stupefyingly unequal distribution of the wealth across the world. Capitalism is the system that has been governing the production of goods and services and their distribution for the last 150 years, and that's its result. 10% of the people have 86% of the wealth, and the other 90%, the vast majority, fight over the remaining 14% of the world. There are roughly 100,000 individuals in the world who own more than $50 million each. 100,000. What's our population? 6 or 7 billion. 100,000, a tiny percentage, are people who have each of them more than $50 million. Quite a few of them have more than $1 billion. But the details there are not worth throwing at you. It's the central idea that we live in an economic system, capitalism, which asks us to be loyal to it, which asks us to believe it's the best the human race can do, and it produces a distribution of global wealth as calculated by one of the leading banks of this capitalist system, Credit Suisse. It concludes that 10% at the top own 86% of the wealth. I don't think I can make a comment that is adequate to get that idea across. Let me turn next, please, to the problem of Switzerland and its remarkable democracy. Switzerland has a law which is remarkable. Here you have a country that allows its people, its 8 million people, the number of people in Switzerland roughly equal to the population of New York City, but it allows its people something that the people of New York do not have. If 100,000 people in Switzerland sign a petition that they want the people of Switzerland to have a vote, it is put up for vote absolutely right away. It's usually a matter of weeks between filing a petition where you've gotten 100,000 of your fellow citizens to sign it and having it put for a vote for the people. Two recent efforts, one has already succeeded in getting its 100,000 signatures, and the other one is expected to do so shortly. Okay. These are worth my bringing to your attention. First, the one that has already received the go-ahead, and the vote in Switzerland will be on November 24th. This proposal runs as follows, that in all Swiss businesses with 1,000 or more employees, all larger businesses, the highest paid person cannot be paid more than 12 times what the lowest paid person can be. That's what this referendum, if it passes, would impose. And it comes clearly out of the anger of the Swiss people, built up over the last 10 or 20 years, as they have read in the newspapers and seen on television, the enormous gap between the richest citizens in their country and around the world and the poorest. In a way, it's the Swiss people's reaction to the extraordinary inequality with which today's program began, with the irony that it's a Swiss bank that brought this report to public attention. In the United States, just to give you a contrast, in the typical large American corporation, the top 1,000 or 2,000 corporations that do such a disproportionately large part of the business of the U.S. economy, the typical gap between the top income of the CEO, chief executive officer, and the lowest paid worker is about 350 to 1. So if something like the Swiss referendum were to happen here, and if the majority of Americans were to support it, it would involve a one-shot attack on inequality of staggering proportions, reducing the gap in the United States from 350 to 1 to 12 to 1. Notice, you still have quite a bit of inequality if some people can earn 12 times what other people can. So this is not a proposal for everybody to get the same. It is a proposal to deal with extreme inequality. And it suggests that in this rather placid, stolid Swiss society, even there is a growing resentment and bitterness about an economic system that generates such inequality. But here's the second proposal from the Swiss that is expected to get the 100,000 signatures and to be on the ballot in Switzerland before the end of 2013. And this may surprise you more. This time, the effort is to get less inequality, not by pressing down from those at the top, but by pushing up for those at the bottom. Here's the proposal. Every adult, every person in Switzerland who's an adult, as soon as he or she reaches adulthood, however it's defined in Switzerland, 18 years, 20 years, whatever it happens to be, would be given a guaranteed annual income. That's right, you heard me correctly. Whether you work or not, there would be a floor below which no Swiss citizen, who's an adult, would be allowed to fall. And how much is it? 2,500 euros a month. In dollars, $2,800 a month. $33,000 a year. A couple living together, their minimum income would be $66,000 a year. That's what the people of Switzerland are going to be voting on. Compare it to your own country, and ask yourself whether you've ever had such an opportunity to express your views on that subject. Whether anyone leading your society has ever offered you such an opportunity. Whether, in short, you are a member of a society that is democratically open to proposing, debating, and deciding that question, or not. Switzerland is a model, and it may be the model for other countries looking for ways to deal with the inequality growing worse by the day in those other countries. The third update deals with something that is, of course, very much in the news. And this has to do with the stalemate at the highest levels of the United States government between the Democratic Party, which controls the White House, President Obama, and the United States Senate on the one side, and the Republican Party, which is dominant in the House of Representatives, on the other. They are now at a stalemate, having refused to provide the money for the government to spend, so that we are speaking in the United States of a government shutdown since the 1st of October. And they are confronting the deadline of October 17, when the government will face a ceiling, it's called. It's a law that says, as of the 17th, the government has reached the limit of how much money it can borrow. And it can't borrow anymore after the 17th because it will be at that ceiling. That means that after the 17th of October, the government can only spend the amount of money coming in taxes. It can't spend more because to do that, it would have to borrow, and that's what the ceiling on the debt of the United States makes impossible. So the president has asked the Republicans to pass a bill to raise the ceiling so that the government can borrow more money and can then spend what the budget that the parties have agreed to requires them to spend going forward. The Republicans have refused, demanding all kinds of concessions. Then they'll raise the limit. The Democrats don't want to give them those concessions, particularly having to do with the Obama health care plan that was passed by Congress and certain other demands. So they're at a stalemate. I wanted to explain what it is that's at stake and do two things. One, tell you what's going to happen on the 17th if they cannot reach an agreement. And secondly, some analysis of this whole situation, which strikes so many people as incomprehensible, bizarre, and strange. First, a little history. Parties have been doing that in the United States for years. When the Republicans are the presidential party, the Democrats want to get concessions by refusing to raise the limit if they control Congress. So the Republicans and Democrats have played this game before. What's different this time is we're in a bad economic crisis, and the polarization of American politics is so extreme that it becomes possible that they will not reach an agreement. So I did some research and found, so had others, asking the question, what will happen? What will happen in this situation? And I got help there from the Goldman Sachs research team, people who work for Goldman Sachs, the bank. And they give the following statistic, which I think is interesting, that come October 17th, give or take a day, the amount of money coming in taxes after that, will be about 65% of what the government is supposed to be spending on all the things that the government at Washington is obligated and has been doing, paying for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, paying out Social Security to people eligible for that, providing loans for students going to school, inspecting our food to determine whether it's safe to eat it, and so on. All the functions of government. If the government were to play uniform with everything, they would have to stop spending a dollar on everything they had been spending a dollar on and only spending 65 cents. Because that they can do since that money is coming in to the government in taxes. So everybody would take a 35% cut. Soldiers in their pay, inspectors in their salaries, or the agencies would have to handle their 35% cut in funding by firing large numbers of public employees. One big question that has agitated many is that one of the big expenditures of the federal government is paying back its loans from the past, particularly from the last few years when the United States government borrowed over $1 trillion a year trying to cope with the economic crisis of capitalism that has plagued us since 2007. So the government owes interest on all that borrowing it did, and it has to pay those folks back. So it could say to them, we're going to give you 65 cents on the dollar. That is, that's the money coming in taxes. That's what we're allowed to spend because the Congress has not allowed us to raise the ceiling and borrow more. We could borrow more. We know that there are businesses and countries willing to lend money to the United States government, as they've been doing for the last 50 years at a record pace, but we're not allowed to. Well, Goldman was interested. It was interested first in saying, my goodness, that's a threat to all of us being big banks like Goldman, who own a lot of the government debts. They're the people who will not get paid back and will not earn interest if that debt ceiling isn't raised, which is one reason why a big group of them went over the last 2 or 3 weeks repeatedly to Washington, in person in some cases and electronically in others, begging, pleading, and threatening the politicians to get this solved. Goldman asked, suppose the government decided not to cut payback to people who've lent money to the government, not to cut payback to the countries who've lent. By the way, the single largest creditor foreign creditor of the United States would be the People's Republic of China, the Communist government of China, which would be very disturbed, to say the least, if they weren't paid the interest and repayment of the debt that they've accumulated as the United States' largest foreign creditor. But Goldman asked, suppose the government, to avoid defaulting on any debt, paid everything it owed to its creditors. Then, of course, they wouldn't be cutting them from 100% to 65%, but it would mean they'd have to cut everybody else in the United States even more. Goldman Sachs calculates we could have a 10, 20, depending on how you count, 30% cut in our output. Our economy would be hobbled, even worse than was threatening in the autumn of 2008 with capitalism's crisis, if the debt ceiling isn't raised. So what's going on? We're threatened now with major economic catastrophe if the folks in Washington don't reach an agreement. Now, I should be clear to you, since I'm based here in New York City and I speak with people on Wall Street all the time, that the overwhelming majority of people think mostly this is theater and there will be an agreement, if not on or before the 17th of October, then shortly thereafter. Too many people are putting too much pressure on these politicians for them to dare to continue to do what they're doing because they're displeasing their patrons, the big banks, the big companies who provide directly or through their executives most of the money that keeps the two major parties and their candidates in business. But let's take a look at the deeper question here, which I know many of you are interested in because you've been sending me so many questions about it. Here's the deeper problem that you will not read about as often as you might, and that you need to, in the press or hear about on radio and television. Capitalism is an economic system that produces gross inequality. That's why I began today's program reading to you just how gross the inequality is globally, not just in the United States or Western Europe, but really everywhere. A tiny portion of our population owns the wild majority of the wealth, and the wild majority of our people fight over the little bit that's left. That means that capitalism, a system that produces that output, is always in a very tenuous relationship with the government. And let me explain why. Wherever you have a system where people have one person, one vote, that is, they have suffrage, they have the right to elect their governmental officials every year, every 2 or 3 or 4 years, that's not so crucial for the moment. But imagine a system which makes a tiny portion of the people wildly wealthy at the expense of everybody else, trying to coexist with a political system that says to the majority, you control the government. The tiny minority made wealthy in and by capitalism have long understood the dangers of such a system. And that danger is easily expressed. It's always possible that the majority, fighting over the little bit of wealth they get, might use their political power, the power of the ballot box, the power of being the vast majority, to put in place a government which would take its power as the state and redistribute the wealth to make it much less unequal. That's what the people in Switzerland are doing. That's what people in other parts of the world are beginning to think about doing, in one way or another. So the people who are the top in a capitalist economy always have reason to fear the government when the government is democratic, at least in the sense that the mass of people have the majority of the votes. That is why in all capitalist societies, the capitalists, the ones with the wealth, push hard and use their wealth to get political parties and candidates and programs that do the following: keep the state poor, keep the state in debt, keep the state on the wrong side of what people think is good in a society. In other words, badmouth the state, demonize the state, make people fearful of the state, make people angry at the state. All of those things are done by the people at the top because they want a government that is weak, a government that is hobbled, a government that isn't trusted, a government that is disliked. That's a protection for them so that the mass of people, if they even want to, will not be able to have a state to be powerful enough to offset what the capitalist economy does in the way of inequality. So it always pushes people inside every political party that it can reach. And if it can't be successful in getting people inside every party, then it pushes particular parties to be the vanguard, the pusher, the leader of the notion that the state should be poor, that the state should be limited, that the state should be small, that the state shouldn't be trusted. In short, the program of the Republican Party in the United States and its counterpart parties all around the world. But here's the problem. Sometimes the capitalists want the state to be strong and to have resources and to be admired. In other words, the capitalists have a contradictory relationship to the state. Why would they want the state to be strong? Here's a reason: to fight off other states that might be crowding them, to fight wars, to keep the world safe for the country's capitalists. They need a strong state. Here's another reason. If they have trouble inside, if they have strikes and labor conflicts, they want to be able to call in the state to help them. They also want, as for example in 2008 and 2009, they want a strong, well-financed state to bail them out of crises that the capitalist system wends its way into on such a regular basis. So the poor capitalists, and I know you understand, I want you to have real sympathy for them, they're caught in a contradiction. They want the state to be weak, limited, and hated for all kinds of reasons, but they also want the state to be strong, rich, and powerful and supported for other reasons. Tough road to hoe. Sometimes they can work it out. Here in the United States, for example, they have supporters in both the Republican and the Democratic Party, sometimes pushing for the state to be powerful and act. For example, the Republicans and Democrats had no problem getting together to vote all the trillions of dollars to bail out the capitalists in 2008 and 2009 when we were on the edge of a major catastrophe economically. At that time, the side that said, make the state strong and powerful and get them busy, won the day. As soon as that was over, the people, the capitalists, got terrified that this government that they had helped make big and strong to bail them out might now be available to the mass of people to say, okay, you help the banks and the corporations, the capitalists, help us. Oh, no. Now we had to shift gear and make the government bad, evil, odious, and you have to cut the taxes and make it weak and make it in debt. We had the shifting. The irrationality of capitalism with its ambivalent and contradictory relationship to the state helps explain the oscillation from spend like crazy to bail out the banks to austerity. We have no money. We can't keep our inspectors looking at the hamburger or our teachers in the school. And it also explains why sometimes the switch from one side to the other gets stuck. And that's where we are now. We're stuck. We have no way to move because those who have demonized the state and wanted small, in this country, Tea Party and Republicans, can't work out a transition back to a state that can help people a little get through a difficult time, which is more the Democratic approach at this point. There's no fundamental difference. They're arguing over the two ways that the capitalists need the state to behave. Help people get through a hard time so they don't become critical of the system, or keep the state weak, poor, and demonized, lest the people use it to make a real difference. That's why we're in the pickle we're in. It isn't about this or that politician or even this or that law or this or that budget crisis. It's about being caught in an economic system that produces fundamental inequality and yet tries at the same time to live with a government that has some power of the mass of people. This is a crazy arrangement, doesn't work, and produces the kinds of crisis we're in. We're going to take now our mid-program break, as we always do. Please stay with us. This is Richard Wolff, Economic Update. We will be back in a matter of seconds. Welcome back. This is Economic Update. I want to turn now to some of the more major issues that I think deserve some attention. This program, as I said at the beginning, and again, this is Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and this is the program that you can follow in detail beyond what we do in our hour, if you will take a look at our two websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. Our first major topic for analysis in this second half of our program has to do with the theme of uneven development looked at from another perspective. It is the theme, really, of our program, that capitalism develops unevenly. It not only makes some areas of the world very wealthy and others poor, some people very rich and the mass of people not. We've already looked at that today. But I want to focus you on a particular consequence of the uneven development of capitalism as a global system. One of the ways capitalism's uneven development changes our lives is that it plunges some parts of the world into such extremes of poverty and of deprivation that they are literally unable to survive in those parts of the world because of their poverty. Their incomes are so low, their wealth is so small because it's concentrated in the hands of people far away, unlike themselves, that they can't stay where they are. Life becomes virtually unlivable. We're talking here about insufficiency of food, insufficiency of water, lack of the most basic services, public education, any sort of health care. But we're also talking about people who get into conflict or into the way of conflict as poor people struggle with one another over the little bit that they have, since it becomes clear to them that if they all shared it equally, they'd all die or perish one way or another. They begin to fight over what little there is, which means some people now, in addition to having barely enough to eat or barely enough shelter, are now caught up in conflicts, military conflicts, of people struggling to survive. At the same time, when an economic system develops as unevenly as capitalism always has and is doing now even more sharply than in the past, what we have is a new kind of situation. The same people that are desperate and can hardly survive where they are able, by means of television, the internet, films, to be confronted almost on a daily basis with spectacles, insights, examples of the extraordinary wealth that is in the hands of those that capitalism favors, the tiny minority. So, for example, people in very desperately poor conditions in Africa are able to see the playgrounds of the rich in London or Paris or Rome, and so they understand something of the disparity. And not only then do they have an incentive to leave where they were born and raised because of the poverty, because of the inequality, because of the direct personal suffering, but they also know that there is a solution, or they think there is one, if they could just go to where all the wealth seems to be concentrated, to leave Africa and to go to Europe, or to leave impoverished parts of Central and South America and go to the United States. And there are parallels everywhere in the world. In other words, the uneven development of capitalism is the fundamental cause of vast migrations of people, vast movements of people from areas that capitalism either never went to or has abandoned into areas where capitalism is concentrating the wealth. People looking for a job, people looking for education for their children, people looking for some minimum standard of housing, or all combinations of these things. We can't be surprised by massive movements of people trying to escape the inequality of the capitalist system that governs our planet. If we don't want migration and all the problems and suffering it brings, then we would have to deal with the underlying economic system and the grotesque inequality that it produces and with which we began today's program. Okay, let me give you two examples. One, over the last week or two, the airwaves have been filled with a tragedy. And it is the tragedy of Eritreans from Africa trying to get across a small stretch of the Mediterranean Ocean, the Mediterranean Sea, from Tunisia in North Africa to Sicily in Italy. It turns out that there's a small Italian island right in that stretch of water called Lampedusa. And what happened a week or so ago was that a boat filled with desperate Eritreans, we now think over 300 people, including almost 100 women and children, drowned when that boat hit a rock or sank or was overturned for some reason. The Italian authorities didn't get there quickly for whatever reason. We'll never know, and the disputes will be endless. But the bottom line here is boats like this are crossing that water all the time because the conditions of people in parts of Africa are unsustainable. As fellow human beings, no one should be put in such a situation. So, of course, they're going to take desperate measures to try to get across to Italy and from Italy through Europe to find some place, somewhere, for themselves and their families to survive, to get however menial a job, and to make life bearable. Who listening to this program would do otherwise? Who would stay in an unsustainable position watching yourself and your family's life chances dissolve, and perhaps their lives as well? Sure, it's chancy. Sure, it's dangerous. Sure, you're going to a place of unknown language, unknown culture, of friendliness or not, danger or not. Of course, you take the chance if not doing it was so clearly a dead end, literally. So we can't be surprised. And however much we shake our heads at the loss of life of that of those poor folks drowning as they tried to escape capitalism's uneven development, we have to understand what the root cause here is and what it means to address it and what hypocrisy attends feeling sympathy or empathy for the victims but failing to face and deal with the known cause. There's another example, and this has to do with workers coming out of Mexico and Central America looking for jobs, picking fruit and vegetables in California. This is a crisis, again, as it has been for decades into the past. And the reason, again, is clear, as it has always been. Life for large numbers of people in Central America, in Mexico and the other Central American countries, is often impossible. Jobs not there. Income not available. Conflict, often violent conflict, between people trying to make a living in the drug trade and a government being pressured to do something about the violence that usually goes with illegal activities like a drug trade. So you have people caught in the crossfire between competing government agencies, often infiltrated by the very drug cartels they're supposed to eliminate and control, and on and on and on. People come to California. Why? They come illegally if they have to, legally if they can, but they're desperate. There is nothing for them where they are coming from, rather like the Eritreans. There might be something, albeit with difficulty and danger and all the risks of being an illegal immigrant, but there might be something for them, as there often has been, picking fruit, picking vegetables in the vast agricultural industry of California. They were once called braceros. These were people who were living under awful conditions, which they accepted often in California because the conditions they had come from back in Mexico and Central America were much worse. And so they were ripped off and exploited by the farmers who hired them and who knew that they had over them the fact that they could be deported back to where things were even worse than not being paid well or not even being paid at all. And that led finally to a heroic movement led by a man who is considered a hero now in California. Cesar Chavez formed the United Farm Workers. And in 1964, they got some laws passed and they got some guarantees of decent wages. But like any gain of working people in a capitalist system, if you don't maintain your workers' organizations, your labor unions, your political parties, your mass mobilizations, whatever you win in the system can and will be taken back. And so the benefits and protections of the workers from the immigrant sources in California were eaten away. And the current H-2A system basically takes them back to the old Bracero system that Cesar Chavez so courageously overcame. So we're back again to an immigration law which has in it the loopholes that will allow for the same catastrophic abuse of people to continue and grow in the fields of California the way it once did in the 40s and 50s under the Bracero program. Maybe the people don't die, although I'm sure many do along the way, from illness that could have been dealt with, from injuries that might have been avoided. But okay, it didn't happen. But again, the problem is, if you develop wealth in California and abject poverty in Mexico and Central America, the movement of people is the result. And the abuse of those people and tragedy for those people is likewise the result. We don't want the tragedy and we don't want the abuse. We have to deal with the underlying cause of this catastrophe, wherever it occurs. And that is an economic system whose output of inequality, as documented as we began today's program, is a fundamental issue that we have to deal with. In the time that remains today, let me address with you a question that many of you have sent me. And it goes back to this stalemate in the United States government and indeed to the wave of austerity politics around the world. I noticed that an important meeting this last week in Washington of the IMF had to be postponed, broken up, because the leader of this meeting, who happens also to be a high official of the Dutch government, the government in the Netherlands, had to excuse himself from the meeting in Washington of the IMF to go back home because there's a crisis in Holland. And guess why? Holland has, for 8 of the last 10 quarter of a year, been in a deep recession. It's having terrible troubles because of the economic crisis of capitalism. And it's trying to solve that crisis by imposing austerity on the Dutch people, cutting government spending for all kinds of social programs. The Dutch have a very high degree of social programs, like the Germans, the Swedes, and so on. So cutting this is still leaving them ahead of workers in most countries, but it's something the working class of Holland does not want and is fighting through its trade unions, the Socialist Party, and so on. So there's a crisis. There you can see how the crisis produces, the crisis of global capitalism, produces a political crisis in the little country of the Netherlands, which has to recall its politician, which impedes the work of the IMF for the global economy in Washington. The power and the influence of the problems of capitalism reach everywhere. Let me then conclude, though, as I promised, by dealing with the question many of you have asked me about. Is there something to the following kind of argument you have asked me? And this argument runs as follows. When a society borrows, it means one of the following two things you often hear. First, that the current generation is borrowing to live well, and that it will be the next generations that have to pay the bill. In other words, to borrow now has a certain immorality associated with it, because it imposes burdens on the unborn generations to come who will have to pay. And the other thing that's said about borrowing today by a state is that it means that we, the whole nation, is living beyond our means. And again, the moral message is, no, 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 you shouldn't do it. These are arguments put forward by the people who want to impose austerity, whose goal in the current crisis is to cut spending on schools, hospital, social services, social security, and all of that, and who want to scare people into thinking that that's necessary if you don't want to burden your children with the debts we run up now, and you don't want to live beyond our means as if we were profligate and wild spenders. Let's be clear. This has nothing to do, the issue of borrowing today has nothing to do with burdening future generations or living beyond our means. And I can explain that quickly. The reason we borrow today is not because we can't find resources to do things otherwise. We can. Let me give you a crystal clear example from the United States. In the 1950s and 60s, we taxed corporations in the United States much more heavily than we do today. We have cut taxes on corporations drastically by cutting the rates, by creating countless loopholes, and above all, by making it easy for corporations to develop subsidiaries in other countries, have their profits show up there, pay very small taxes to that country, and not pay them here. Easy to show, no disagreement by anyone who knows the reality. Not only have we stopped taxing corporations the way we once did and shifted the burden instead to individuals, but over the last 50 years, we have shifted the burden among individuals from those at the top to the middle and the bottom. It is as stark as anyone could possibly want to see. For example, in the 50s and 60s, the top income tax rate for the richest Americans was 91%. Today, it's 39.6%. You notice that cut from 91 to 39.6. But much more than that, the whole income tax for everybody has been cut. And we've made it less than half of the money the government takes in. It used to be much more. In its place, we have raised the payroll tax. The payroll tax, it's called. And here's the difference between the income tax and the payroll tax. And they bring in about the same amount of money, the federal government, now. The income tax, while it is less burdensome on the rich, way less than it used to be, is still a little bit progressive. That is, you pay a higher percentage the higher your income. The payroll tax is not progressive at all. It is, in fact, regressive. From zero up to about $113,000, everybody pays the same percentage, rich or poor. But if you earn more than $113,000 a year, that's the rich in America, every dollar above $113,000, you pay no payroll tax on it at all, which means the richer you are, the smaller your income of your income goes to pay the payroll tax. So over the last 50 years, the tax burden has been taken off of corporations and put on individuals, and off of high-income individuals and put on middle and low income individuals. That has been such a burden that the mass of people have become committed not to pay any more taxes. They can't carry it. They haven't the money. They're at their end. And here comes the sad political irony of our country. The very corporations and rich who shifted the burden of taxes off of themselves onto the middle and lower incomes, are the ones leading the charge for the mass of people to say no to taxes. If there was ever an example of closing the barn door after all the horses got out, here it is. The corporations and the rich lead the charge to not raise taxes right after they cut their own and raised them for everybody else. Wow. Don't be fooled. If we don't want to borrow money now because we don't want to burden future generations or live beyond our means, then what we ought to do and ought to have done is go back to where we were in the 50s and 60s, a time when we didn't have as much inequality as we do today and our economy grew faster than it does today. The money is there. Tax the corporations, tax the rich. We can do what we need as a decent society, not burden the future, and not live beyond what we can do. Don't be fooled. Thank you very much for being with me on Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. I look forward to seeing you next week. And please remember to follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Thank you.
Change, baby. Your time now, baby. But after a while, it's gonna be my time, baby. They ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.